Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. Eastern in North America. No, wait a minute. It's not, is it? It's only 2 p.m. Eastern in North America, 3 p.m. Atlantic Canada, 3:30 Newfoundland, 7 p.m. London, 8 p.m. Paris. Yeah, there's a reason for that. We're doing our Clubland Q&A a couple of hours earlier today because it's a rather busy day for me. At 4 p.m. Eastern, it'll be Stein's Song of the Week on 7AID Radio in the United Kingdom. That's 9 p.m. BST. BST, bovine spongiform time? No, it's British summertime. And that's Stein's Song of the Week. About an hour after we wrap up here on 7AID Radio across the United Kingdom, you can listen from anywhere on the planet by going to their website and clicking the button in the top right-hand corner. And a couple of hours after that, I'll be with my chum Pete Hegseth on Fox News Primetime. And about an hour after that wraps up, I'll be back at Stein Online for episode 5 of our current Tale for Our Time, Jack London's Burning Daylight. So this is basically the first of a quadruple bill. You know how it works, though. We're not changing the format or anything. All you have to do to ask me a question is be a Mark Stein Club member. If you have no question that occurs, then don't bother joining the club. Steer clear, because it's totally free to listen anywhere you are on this turbulent earth of ours. But if you do want to ask me a question and you're a club member, we try to get a few newbies questions in. So if you've just joined in recent weeks, do mention it and we'll try and promote you to the top of the line just to ensure that you get your question in. This is a newbie's question. Well, newish, third month, so that would make it, what, April or whatever? Yeah, I'd regard that as a newish member. From Niagara-on-the-Lake, he goes under the name Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli. That's not a Niagara-on-the-Lake thing. I stayed at Niagara-on-the-Lake. I had a lovely week there. What's that hotel? The Prince of Wales. It has rather, I'm a loyal monarchist, and it certainly doesn't want for pictures of often quite obscure members of the royal family all over every inch of wall in the Prince of Wales Hotel. And I thought, my God, I don't know if even I can. I mean, I take my allegiance to the Queen seriously, but I don't know whether I can. This might be a bit too much. But by about the third day, you're used to it. Seeing a badly done portrait of one of the Marquess of Lorne's family members hanging on the wall as you go in for afternoon tea isn't so distressing. Anyway, I love Niagara-on-the-Lake. Actually, they have some very good meat pies there. I'm warming to my theme here. And I bought a pair of Chelsea boots there too. I don't think I've worn Chelsea boots in like 30 years, but I suddenly decided I got a yen to buy a pair of Chelsea boots, and you can buy them in Niagara-on-the-Lake. Also, Niagara-on-the-Lake. Okay, we're doing the full hour on Niagara-on-the-Lake. If you want to talk about anything else, to hell with you. You'll have to go and find some other show. The other thing I like about Niagara-on-the-Lake is they adopted a new municipal flag, and they did a traditional ensign. And the ensign, they used the pre-1801 Union Jack in the upper left-hand quadrant of their ensign. It's a very stylish new ensign, the new municipal flag of Niagara-on-the-Lake. Niagara-on-the-Lake, as you know, American listeners, you might want to avert your ears for this, but the thing you know about Niagara-on-the-Lake, it was burnt to the ground by the Americans in the War of 1812. And if you go to Niagara-on-the-Lake now, it's this lovely, sheeshy little town, and you're looking directly across the river, the Niagara River, from Buffalo. So you're standing there on the Niagara-on-the-Lake side, which the Americans burnt to the ground, totally destroyed in the War of 1812, and you're looking across the river at Buffalo. And any space alien apprised of the general facts would assume that, in fact, it was Buffalo that had been burnt to the ground. And actually, large parts of it still look a bit burnt to the ground. Anyway, enough of Niagara-on-the-Lake. Leave the gun, take the cannoli says, my first question, here goes, I'm so nervous. Long-time listener, first-time questioner. Tucker, of whom I am a great fan, has asked aloud on two different occasions, why has not Governor Abbott called out the Texas State National Guard to protect and shut down the illegal invasion on his southern border? Most recently last night while interviewing former White House aide Stephen Miller. That's right, he asked Mr. Miller, why hasn't Governor Abbott called out the National Guard to shut down the border? So far, says our questioner, I've not heard the answer to this question. Miller enumerated quite eloquently all the laws, statutes, and treasonous acts being transgressed, but answers of why Abbott has not protected his Texans et al. From this insidious flow are not forthcoming. As you are not a conspiracy theorist, what is your conspiracy theory for Abbott's inaction? A fantastical statistic of 1 million illegal aliens have been let in over the last 6 months. This is folly by any measure. Yeah, I think that actually it's worth thinking of those numbers because most countries aren't very big. So if you let in a million of anything, it's a consequential act. There's whatever it is, approximately 4 million Norwegians, New Zealanders. Most countries are quite small. Most of the most agreeable countries to live in are quite small. And once you get up to a certain number, most of the countries that are quite agreeable to live in tend to be the English-speaking nations, such as Canada and Australia, the United States and so forth. The United States is, even though the United States is over 300 million people, if you start letting a million here, a million undocumented aliens, a million people, you have no idea who they are. You know why? You know why the left wants to abolish the Electoral College in America? The Electoral College, they always say, privileges small states like my own, New Hampshire, or even smaller ones population-wise like Vermont and Wyoming, which, you know, whatever it is, it's 500,000 and change, maybe 600,000 now. But in other words, just the number of illegal aliens they know they've let in, as opposed to all the ones they don't know they've let in, this year outnumber the population, or match the population of Wyoming and Vermont combined. Okay, so the first thing that happens if you abolish the Electoral College is that essentially 6 months' intake of illegal aliens outvotes Wyoming and Vermont. What was the rest of the question? Oh, yeah, why doesn't Governor Abbott? So wait a minute, you're from Niagara-on-the-Lakes. I did 5 minutes about Niagara-on-the-Lakes new ensign. Great quality of the meat pies, bad art at the otherwise lovely Prince of Wales Hotel. And then I did another 5 minutes on, the sheer numbers. But you want to know why Governor Abbott doesn't do what Tucker has proposed and call out the National Guard to shut down the illegal invasion on his southern border. Well, the point is that it would be portrayed in the media as a usurpation of federal authority. Then it would be taken to court and an injunction temporarily halting the National Guard's actions at the southern border. So then you would be relying... Now, whether you think a district judge has the authority to do that, you'll then have to factor in whether a military commander is going to defy the district court judge. And the complications of that, the thing about that is that can start off for a politician who's interested, for whom self-preservation comes before all else. The question is whether that's going to be one of those things that just unravels very quickly and destroys him. Now, if you compare Ron DeSantis in Florida, he's got a website and He's got a website that sells T-shirts saying, "Don't Fauci my Florida," or whatever. And people are annoyed about that because it's dissing the great Fauci. And that's all well and good. And it's easier, but it's easier to get points for courage by doing something like that than doing something like closing the border of your state. And then it all winding up in court, it all winding up in a showdown over whether the National Guard commanders obey you or whether they obey the judge. And the risk for that is, again, this is where, as I say, in the end, constitutions and whatever other forms of government you have take second place to the prevailing cultural realities. It would Governor Abbott, I have no particular view on him one way or the other, but it would require an extraordinary and unprecedented level of political courage for him to do that. And I don't see any evidence that, you know, I'm not singling him out or whatever. I think letting in, particularly in a pandemic, when we're supposedly told that the movement of peoples, unnecessary movement of peoples, which all governments, now the government of Canada, the government of the United Kingdom, the European Union, Australia, they all say, oh, no unnecessary movement. But at the same time, you have open borders and millions of people coming in whose COVID status, you know, it's all, you know, it's basically theatre. And if you want to convert it from theatre to something real, like saying these, we're not letting in. You know, there's no reason why we should admit, pandemic or otherwise, why we should admit a population the equivalent of the size of Wyoming and Vermont into our state across our border. There's no reason for that. And if the federal government won't act, I'd love to see a governor do that. But it would require extraordinary courage. And it would require him to show courage of a kind that is not generally found in the Republican Party. Janet Long says, so Mark, trying not to be dense here, but I'm still trying to figure out why the corporations who supported this administration and knew what the taxation policies would be now feel about the list of taxes that will hit them if Schumer is able to get them through the Senate and onto Joe's desk. If they pledged allegiance to Joe and every other wokeism that came along, have they been promised immunity? Are they okay with an eventual government takeover? Are these CEOs okay with the wealth taxes hitting their own wallets? What am I missing here, oh wise one? Well, don't forget that the corporate support for Biden and BLM and wokeism comes mainly from the big multinationals. We have seen over the year and a half of the COVID and the lockdown, a massive transfer of corporate power away from small businesses, mom-and-pop businesses, to global near-monopolies like Amazon. And those people have been the wokest of the woke, the BLMist of the BLM. And I honestly do, if you think of it, if they were just businessmen, they would not be doing half of this stuff anyway. Because businessmen generally take, it used to be, well, it's still the case if you're in small town New Hampshire, for example, you don't generally find the general store owner running for a seat on the school board or the select board, because at that point he becomes a controversial figure to the few hundred people in his town, and he doesn't want half the townsfolk coming in and buying their quart of milk from him because he cut the school budget or whatever. So generally speaking, if you're a small businessman, you don't want to get mixed up in politics because your profit margins are such, your profit margins are such that you can't take the hit from being the least bit controversial. Now, it's different when you're Amazon or when you're Google or when you're the wokest of the woke, because their profit margins, they've all got richer this last year. There's people who come, I don't know how it washes out if you're Delta or Coca-Cola or these guys. I don't know how that washes out. But a lot of these people have made the decision that actually there's nowhere else to go. You all, everybody, that it won't... The political price to pay for going for the woke stuff won't hurt them. Now, these new taxes, you know, again, the wokest, Amazon, Google, won't be paying any of them. They'll figure a way out around them, just as they already have done. You know, Google pays less tax in the United States than me. You know, that's the craziness, because they route it through the Irish, double Dutch, via Bermuda, you know, all that stuff. All that stuff. So that's the reason they're doing that. We've had a couple of questions. This James P. says, I would be interested in your take on the civil unrest in South Africa. Is this a function of the special circumstances of that country, or a preview of increasing violence in the US and elsewhere, as our shared civic cultures continue to be eroded? And another James, Jim from New Jersey, says, Mark, I'm curious to hear if you have any thoughts about what's currently taking place in South Africa. It's being reported only in the alternative media that parts of the country have rapidly become war zones, with all food and energy infrastructure destroyed. The lack of interest from corporate media in what is taking place there troubles me. And Jim goes on to say, could this be due in part to the conflict not fitting into their sophomoric white versus black paradigm? From what I've been able to sort out, the trouble began when former President Zuma, Jacob Zuma, a Zulu, was arrested by his successor on corruption charges, but the intensity and ferocity of the unrest doesn't make sense. What especially concerns me is that this has not been the typical retail looting spree. Entire food distribution systems, along with power plants and oil refineries, have been systematically destroyed. It seems that this is a well-planned and organized strategy to starve others to death. South Africa is filled with natural resources. Is some group or nation trying to burn the country down so they can go in and take it all? I worry that what we're seeing there could happen in the USA and Europe, and that we're all being primed for this very thing. Well, first of all, just I think the first point that one of the two Jims made, is this it doesn't fit into the white versus black thing? No, because once you've taken out the whites... or sidelined them, made them demographically and then politically irrelevant. What matters is the divisions between the Rainbow Coalition. That's where it's interesting and relevant to the future of the United States or Canada or Western Europe or whatever. Once you end so-called white privilege, everyone's all agreed the whites are awful. Once the whites become irrelevant, then you have all kinds of other interesting divisions that emerge, and generally very quickly, often tribal divisions, as in Zimbabwe. South Africa, you know, it's all demography in the end. South Africa, if you go back 100 years, as we do on the 100 Years Ago show, in fact, we had General Smuts flying in. He was the Prime Minister of South Africa 100 years ago, the predecessor of Jacob Zuma, as it were. There's still a statue of him. Successive prime ministers in London respected him immensely because he was a brilliant man. He was the creator, the driving force behind the Royal Air Force, for example. Field Marshal Smuts, there's still a statue of him in Parliament Square. There's two South Africans in Parliament Square, no Canadians, two South Africans, Field Marshal Smuts and Nelson Mandela. And Smuts is South Africa. People, the things we assume now, oh, majority black. It wasn't necessarily clear 120 years ago that what is now, what became the Union of South Africa, would be majority black. You know, the Boers in particular, there were three groups. There were blacks, there were Boers, the Dutch, Afrikaans-speaking Boers, and the English. The British Isles contribution, and then there was a small number of Indians from India, like Gandhi and that kind of thing. And what happened was, and you would have bet, a lot of people would have bet on the Boers. They were a kind of tough crowd. They were regarded as tough guys. And it used to be quite common if you were like in a bar in Toronto or Dublin or Sydney, late at night, people would express admiration for the no-nonsense Boers. They forgot to have children, though. And so eventually it became clear that the future of South Africa would be black, just because what had started in some of these settler colonies in the Transvaal and Natal and whatever, they were serious about settling them, having children and becoming the population. And in the end, a lot of blacks moved to South Africa and they let them in. This is again why open borders happens. And it became an overwhelmingly majority black state. And once that happens, the people who are there are gonna get the government they'll put up with. That's true everywhere. You know, you have a real problem when people put up with the dictatorship for decades, as they do in Iraq. The idea that they're suddenly going to become Sweden 20 minutes after you invade is idiotic. We're hearing a lot of the same kind of garbage talked about Cubans right now. Regardless of whether people vote for the government, generally speaking, is something. Governments everywhere are what they can get away with. Now, South Africa, then the ANC formed, and the ANC basically came to power in the black areas of South Africa by first ridding itself of all kinds of other local opposition, because everybody wants to take out the white regime. So that's easy. We can all agree on that. So the thing to do is to make sure it's you who gets to take out the white regime by crushing any putative rivals, which the ANC did very effectively. Now, Nelson Mandela, throughout this period, was in prison, so he wasn't terribly involved with that. And that carried on after the deal between him and de Klerk 30 years ago. So Mandela comes to power as the new leader of a new South Africa. But he's basically a weak and remote new leader. Whatever his many qualities, he's a weak and remote new leader simply because he hasn't been there on the ground putting the necklaces around the heads, the tires, where you stick the tire over the head of somebody and set it alight. He wasn't involved in any of that. And so that's good. But what's bad is it means he's not actually connected with it. So he was a weak and remote leader. He was then succeeded by the other fella whose name temporarily slips my mind. Mandela was weak and remote, but courtly and likable. Thabo Mbeki, that's the guy I'm thinking of. He came along then, and he wasn't in the least bit likable, and so they removed him, and you got this guy Zuma, who is likable, has no other qualities. Now, what happened in all this time, under this period of generally unsatisfactory leadership of the ANC, is South Africa became very corrupt. Very corrupt, in a way that would have astonished Smuts. Smuts thought of himself as the prime minister of a first world country. That's why he was, 100 years ago, he was going to Dublin to talk to unionists and Republicans about how to turn yourself from some provincial basket case where you're all shooting and killing each other into a first world country like his, the Union of South Africa. And South Africa isn't like that anymore. South Africa has all the signs of decay that happen when you go from a relatively functioning society into a non-functioning one. Like you notice as you pass through the streets of its cities that the upper floors of office blocks are unlit because the neighbourhood's in decline and so the top floors go unrented and then they go unlit and eventually it's a like another the decay of office blocks, the decay of the decay of tall buildings are a sign of first world societies, and their decay is a sign that you're headed, you know, back to the ground, pretty sharpish, and that's what we've seen with this looting. The looting is taking place like in it's these are the same kinds of guys who were violent in the years before F.W. de Klerk did his deal with Mandela. But the guys who were violent then were violent basically in the townships, in the shanty, in the black areas. Now you've actually got the downtown of Johannesburg being looted, and that is something unknown since the Union of South Africa was formed in 1910. In other words, this is a new scale of things. And now you make a very interesting point that it appears to be organized. Well, who would be organizing it? Zuma was removed for corruption. There were these guys, the Gupta brothers, who basically they're an Indian family who basically because of the weak leadership of the ANC. As I said, South Africa decayed into corruption. Unlike corruption in ramshackle colonies, former colonies such as Zambia, it wasn't corruption by government power, although that's part of it. But it wasn't the usual, you know, dictator fleecing the treasury to oomph up his Swiss bank account. What you had here was a canny family from the Indian mercantile class of South Africa, the Gupta brothers, who basically, because of the rather dilatory administration by the ANC, were able to arrange things very congenially to them. Now, there's a commission that's going on, I think it's still going on, investigating them, run by a rather, you know, impressive and apparently a great man of probity, a judge, such as one would get, exactly the same as a Canadian Royal Commission or an Australian Royal Commission or whatever. The thing, when you look at these things, this looting that's going on now over the jailing of Zuma, and you talk about, is it organized or whatever? Well, the one thing that is well organized in South Africa right now is corruption. And one naturally thinks, well, is it the same kind of people who are, is it the same kind of people behind the corruption who are behind this looting and civil unrest that's going on? I don't know that as I said, the central point to bear in mind here is that, as Jim says, it's not white versus black versus white. Once the whites become irrelevant, everybody turns on each other. You'd be surprised that will be the exact same thing in the United States when wokeism will triumph and all the rainbow coalition, the gays and the Muslims, the transgenders and the feminists, the blacks and the Asians, and they'll all hold hands for 12 seconds and then they'll turn on each other. Maria DiGiorgio writes, "Hi Mark, I enjoyed your interviews with J.D. Vance very much. Why do you think the media is so interested in punishing him for past tweets about Donald Trump and for deleting some? What's the big deal? Also, are there any other political newcomers that we should also be paying attention to, ones who are talking about big picture issues like Mr. Vance?" Well, as you know, I don't care about candidates. I like candidates when they say something interesting. So J.D. Vance is more interesting to me than most people because he came up with this rather pithy way of saying we traded healthy communities for cheap garbage from China, which is the history of America. When everything else is cleared away, that's the history of America this last half century. That's why America's not number one. That's why China's number one. And why we're all headed to evade DARPA. And he said that, and you couldn't get Mitch McConnell to say that, you know. That's, again, the fault with the American system, I would say, because Mitch McConnell is basically the equivalent of an overpaid and over-entouraged whip in a parliamentary system. So he never says anything interesting. So much of the political coverage is on people who are just, by definition, totally uninteresting, like Mitch McConnell. Why, you say, though, Maria, why are the media interested in punishing him for his past tweets about Donald Trump? Because that's the only cudgel they have. There's a piece in The Atlantic which is quite incredible. It's appallingly written. The whole thing, you couldn't even have got it back when The Atlantic was a real magazine, as recently as 10 years ago, you couldn't have got it in the magazine because it's so badly written. But this guy, the writerly bit of it is that he's trying to find the appropriate word for J.D. Vance. And he lets you know, he signals that the appropriate word is asshole, right? A-S-S-H-O-L-E. A rather dull and overused Americanism, in my view. But his thing is, and so he says he's fighting off the urge to call J.D. Vance a word that begins with A and is followed by double S-H-O-L-E. And he takes, he writes his 3,000-word piece, and then he says, oh, no, to hell with it, he is an asshole. That's the piece. You can read it at The Atlantic. Why is he doing that? Because Vance is effective and McConnell isn't. Because Susan Collins isn't effective. Because Mitt Romney isn't effective. Because Mitt Romney never says anything about anything that matters. And J.D. Vance has just said, basically, we traded healthy communities for cheap crap from China. And he's saying things I said last year and the year before, whatever, so that's why I like it. But he's saying it as a Republican Senate candidate from Ohio, because it's what happened to Ohio, just as it's what happened to anywhere. You drive any direction within 50 miles of where I'm sitting right now, and it tells you whether you're talking miserable Grafton County, New Hampshire, happen to know very well, unless you're a college town or a ski resort or you're a dormitory town for the college and the ski resort, it's nothing. Northeast Kingdom of Vermont, same thing. Rutland, Vermont. Western Maine, same thing. I mean, it shouldn't be unusual to say we traded healthy communities for cheap crap from China. We traded healthy communities. It's actually, I won't name it, but not too far from where I'm sitting. There's a town that used to have sawmills, and it was named for the guy who put in the first sawmills, and the sawmills closed, and it got a Walmart. And the Walmart is cheap, and so you don't really need to have a great job. You can be doing the night shift at the quickie crap and still afford to buy things at Walmart. But everything in Walmart is made in China. Every time you're in Walmart, it's actually transferring not just the American economy, but American but the broader community and culture to China. And and people don't want you talking about that. You know, the great thing about whoever you want to name, those 17 guys on stage before Trump entered the race in 2015, the great thing about the majority of them is they never talked about that. They never put it on the table. And J.D. Vance has put it on the table, and that's good. KJT writes, I heard you and Andrew Lawton speak about the burning of churches and indifference from political elites on your show yesterday. Is it possible to recapture the veneration of faith, or is that over? Well, there's another central question of our time. In case you haven't heard about this, I think that Andrew mentioned there were, I think, 27 churches now in Canada that have been burned to the ground. And I think there's another 18 that have been partially destroyed. So we're up around 45 churches. Now, if you had been told, oh, 45 churches have been burned, you'd think, oh, what's this? Is this ISIS in Syria? Is it fanatics in Pakistan or Sudan or the remnants of the Iraq Christian community that disgracefully was destroyed on the West's watch? Is this the latest news from Syria, Iraq, Sudan, Pakistan? No, it's from the Dominion of Canada. And there is a calculated silence from certain persons. Now, you have evil men like Justin's advisor, Gerald Butts. Gerald Butts. He's no fan of mine. He's always going on about what a racist I am. He's basically a fanatical, corrupt progressive who believes that somehow who advises Justin to stay silent on the church burning. Because in political terms, there's nothing in it for him in making it into an issue. So we have a weird thing where dozens of churches, Catholic churches mostly, and if you want to know something about the decline of Trudopia, Justin's father, he was quite serious at the end of his life. I mean, he basically became an observant Catholic at the funeral. But he was serious about that in his last days. As someone who had had the usual, he had contempt for anything ancient, such as the church or the monarchy or whatever, because his whole thing was about remaking Canada in his own image. I always compared him to Liberace, made one of his lovers have plastic surgery to look like Liberace, in order that Liberace could experience the sensation of making love to himself. And that's the best summation of what Pierre Trudeau did to Canada, basically. And the difference with Justin, I think, is that Justin has been advised by Butts and these other guys, there's nothing for you in making this into a big deal. So in political terms, mentioning church burnings isn't worth it for you. Now, when you look at the CBC and the rest of the Toronto Star and the rest of the Canadian media and all the rest of it, there's an element of that, but there is also, I think, a genuine indifference to faith. And Andrew and I didn't really talk about this yesterday, but it is striking to me when I reviewed Welbeck's novel Submission, a couple. I don't think I reviewed it. I think I just mentioned it. But the thing, when you read that novel is about an Islamic party coming to power through various machinations in France, and so France semi-Islamizing. And this guy, the central character, is a professor, and he makes a conscious effort to recover his faith. And he tries really hard. He's a cultural Catholic. He understands that France is Catholic. He understands that Europe is Christendom. And that there are not many ways back out of hell that do not involve re-embracing Christianity in some way or other. And yet, despite all his great effort, he cannot. I don't want to give the book away, But the where he tries. And you can, and that's a novel, and it's a novel that is well worth your time to read. Submission is available in English. But you can, if you don't want to read a novel, you can read actually Douglas Murray on The Strange Death of Europe, in which he comes to the same conclusion as Welbeck's protagonist, that only by reconnecting with the faith of the ancient continent, the faith of Europe, only in Christendom is there an answer, ultimately an answer to Europe's woes. And yet Douglas himself is not a believer. And so his suggestion is that we should all try to reconnect with the church culturally. And there's lots of people who like Anglican hymns and the language of the Book of Common Prayer. But it's a tough sell to say, look, you don't believe in the central idea of this thing, but the music's not bad, and its use of language is pretty impressive. It's a tough, and the buildings are nice. And that isn't true in Canada, because the buildings right now are increasingly charred. But at some point, you know, no society lasts without a transcendent meaning. And historically, through the generations, the transcendent meaning has been faith. You know, you can see it in our building. Nobody builds cathedrals anymore, because those cathedrals were built by men who knew they would never live to see them, who in some cases it was touch and go whether their sons or grandsons would live to see them. But they built them because they believed in the future, because they believed in a transcendent meaning to life. Now, if you don't believe in a transcendent meaning to life, you build the crap that passes for, you know, including church buildings that you see all around you now. It's difficult. You know, the hyper-rational, there's a lot of very clever rationalists about it. Well, on Fox News Primetime, we had Heather MacDonald on. I think it was on Thursday or Friday show. Heather regards herself as a secular conservative. There's plenty of people who don't believe, but an atheist, a thoughtful atheist, generally understands that it's easier to be an atheist in a nominally Christian society than in a Muslim society. And if he thinks that through a bit further, he will understand that, in effect, Christianity protects his atheism in a way that Islam certainly does not. So all these atheists are going to have... Well, again, I won't tell you the plot twist, but if you read Michel Houellebecq's novel Soumission, you'll know he gets that bit too, that people who will not reconnect to the faith of their fathers will find themselves connecting with an entirely different faith, faute de mieux, when that comes a calling. Michelle Dulac says, Mark, what do you think of Mayorkas's admonition to Cuban and Haitian refugees? Am I wrong in thinking that he himself was a Cuban refugee back in the day? I don't know anything about him. I can't be bothered to get interested in him. You should try one of these Rush Successor shows for that. They're all over the place. You can, if you don't like today's successor to Rush, there'll be another successor to Rush along any minute. But they might know that, because they're always going on about hypocrisy, as if they think that's going to win it for them. And it won't. Michelle continues, I understand that migration by sea is very risky, but what then of the US's pledge to drop migrants off in some third country? And why is that okay now, but not with regard to migrants from the Central American Triangle who have the luxury of not living on an island? Because more Cubans... by boat means more Cubans in Florida, which means Florida becomes Republican. And if Florida is Republican, then that makes it possible for Republicans to win national elections. Or at any rate, it imposes more difficulties on the democracy kleptocrats of the Democrat Party, because they got to organize more stuff to steal. So they don't want them. They don't want Cubans, because Cubans are going to settle in the Miami area and make Florida more Republican. And that's why that is. Michael Covino writes, "Hi Mark, Chairman Xi said on July the 1st, the Chinese people will never allow any foreign forces to bully, oppress or enslave us. Anyone who dares will have their heads cracked and their blood will flow before the steel Great Wall built with the flesh and blood of 1.4 billion Chinese people." Yeah, didn't I quote this? Was it on telly last week? I think I quoted it somewhere. Besides the personal pecuniary interest Joe and his family have in China, why is the Biden regime and the Dems unwilling to take Xi's threats seriously? And bravo for your karaoke colonialism line earlier this week on Tucker. Look, the thing is, they're on the same side. Lower down, you can see this in Fauci's emails. It's fascinating to me. If you match Fauci's emails in January and February with his public utterances, what he says in private tells you that he knows China has won, so you don't want to get on the wrong side of China. And this is his assumption. In the case of the Biden family, it's a cruder assumption. But if you look at, for example, what was revealed from Hunter Biden's laptop about Joe Biden being on the take, Joe Biden isn't really anything. He's just a lifetime political hack who landed with his bottom in the butter, as they say in Belgium. And that butter comes from China. If you know the stuff, right, the stuff the media, the corrupt court eunuchs of the American media weren't interested in before the election, from that laptop of Hunter Biden, and you know what that reveals about Joe Biden being on the take. He's just a guy on the take. He's like a grubby little ward healer who happened to find a particularly generous political master. So you look at what, and I'm just not making this in a political way, because I loathe the Republican Party. I don't really like having to say anything nice about them. I absolutely despise them. I'm not really a political person in American terms. The Republican Party is contemptible but incompetent. The Democrat Party is contemptible, but has the elemental skill of being able to calculate its own self-interest. So you think of what, and I'm just suggesting this to anybody, if anybody from the New York Times or from CBS News is listening, just put aside your own personal voting preferences for a minute and just look at those emails. You know, you can find them, they're out there. That the Hunter Biden laptop reveals about 10% for the big guy. They're bad. They tell you that this awful, grubby, talentless little hack, this is when his brain was functioning. Now he's just an awful, grubby, talentless, brain-dead hack. They tell you the 10% for the big guy and all the rest of it tells you, you know, this guy is on the take from China big time. That's on Hunter Biden's laptop. That's just the emails that have managed to make their way into the wider. What emails, what texts do you think Chairman Xi is sitting on? You know, why are the Biden regime and the Dems unwilling to take Xi's threat seriously? Because from their point of view, it's over. It's already over. Read the Fauci emails. He thinks China's won. Eric Dale says, "Hey Mark, if women won't stand up to the transgender lobby as women-only spaces and sports are eroded away, And the Catholic Church won't protest as its parishes are burned to the ground. What good does it do for conservatives to stand up for those who put up no effort in their own defence? It feels like a repeating morality play where we're cast in the role of evil reactionaries standing athwart the tolerant and loving leftists before their inevitable triumph. It's like the gay marriage debate of the aughts. We win the mainstream and the polling majority on that issue until a rock-rigged Republican on the Supreme Court wrote Obergefell, and the Conservative Inc. decided this issue wasn't the hill to die on. Yeah, I know. Didn't I mention some little twerp from National Review going on about J.D. Vance's position on same-sex marriage? Okay, that's your big issue. You lost that one. You lost it. You know, as Eric points out, all the numbers are on your side and you still lost. Well, now all the numbers are on the side of the people who don't think that 6'2", with hormone treatment, budding breasts, 5 o'clock shadow, hung like a stallion, should be competing in the girls' school sports in Connecticut. Overwhelmingly, the polls do not favour the trans lobby on that. So how's that likely to end up if it's left to the wanker right that managed to bungle all the other stuff too? Now, you make a very good point. Why isn't Pope Francis, basically dozens of Christian churches, mostly Catholic, mostly his churches, his flock, being burned to the ground in Canada? And what does the social justice pontiff have to say about, oh, sorry, he's too busy talking about climate change or the wonders of Islam or whatever it is that he's talking about this week? And as you say, it's very frustrating to, you know, I have my little bugbears, I have my little problems, and you notice pretty quickly it wasn't true in Canada with the free speech thing. But it's been true in certain things too. How few real friends you have. So you better bloody well speak up for yourself, because other people who don't have a vested interest in it will speak up for a bit and then move on to something else. And the silence. Now, I say this, that this isn't true. There are those feminists, the TERFs, whatever they call them, the trans-exclusionary radical feminists, who take this seriously, and they suffer for it. People who have been on the left for years, like the Catholic Church is on the left. You know, in political terms, do I want to defend the Catholic Church as presided over by Pope Francis? No, they talk bollocks on everything. In political terms. But at the same time, somebody has to speak up for the church burnings in Canada. And again, why aren't the communities in those towns? Well, obviously they're scared. Well, somebody has to stop being scared. And the women, you know, these issues get won because eventually everyone falls silent. Now, with the same-sex marriage, it was a lady, Maggie, what was her name? Maggie Gallagher, was it? National Review, one by one, they all fell silent. Because suddenly it became difficult, you know, to talk about. And one by one, they all fell silent until only Maggie Gallagher over there, National Review, was going on about it. And then when she lost, Maggie, I don't know what, I haven't seen her in a decade. And then she seems to be out of the commentary business and gone. That's the way to bet on the transgender thing. It's over. There's no social consensus for it. It's overwhelmingly unpopular. But again, when women won't speak up as the identity of woman is being now, you know, why do we get? Why do people ask me? People say, why do I go on Fox? Well, occasionally I go on Fox because I just like to say something in a way that other people don't say it. So, for example, when we were talking about the transgender thing last week, and I read this, just before I went on air, I'd read this piece in the Washington Post. It was amazing to me. It was written like, why are conservatives still boring on about transgender issues. Don't they realise that these days you have women with... Some women have penises and some women don't have penises. And yes, it's true, there aren't quite as many women who don't have penises around it as there used to be. The amount of women with penises, it must be up to about 30, 50, 70% right now. But if you look very, very hard, you might still somewhere be able to find a woman without a penis. So why are you uptight squares on the conservative side still making a fuss about this thing? And this is how all the trans stuff is written, and nobody actually... I don't have many great qualities, but occasionally I can put that thing in a, put these things in a way that other people don't, and that's not an unuseful skill. But I am amazed at the and when you do that, then you get media matter. Oh, can you believe transphobic? Blah 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 blah. Okay, well somebody. Why do you think the identity of woman is being erased in our time? It's not just that they've abolished sex. They've abolished the sexes. That's pretty big. But it's worse than that. For women, they're erasing women. They're erasing the identity of women. And I don't understand why. I don't understand. At some point, ordinary people have to say. That's the only... You know what made the difference? I'm told that this is what made the difference. You know, schools, for example. Every dad wants to be involved with his kid's education. But you got to get up in the morning and you got to go to work and then you come home and, yeah, you got time to read the kid a story before bed. But you don't have time to follow all the ins and outs. Oh, yeah, I know, I'm tied up at the office. Could you go to the parent-teacher conference today? What happened this last year? Why is critical race theory taken off as an issue? Because this last year, the teachers' unions, because they're cruel and corrupt and also lazy asses, decided they didn't want to bother teaching in schools. There's a little bit of this elsewhere around the world, but the American teachers' unions are the worst in the Western world, disgraceful, and so they've stuck to it longest. So there's a lot of places still where, you know, kids aren't at school. So instead they've been doing these Zoom lessons around the house. And Mummy was a little bit familiar with all this critical race theory because she's vaguely been keeping an eye on the mumbo jumbo. And what happened was, as I gather, that Dad suddenly discovered, because he's got the kids zooming it in from the bedroom, and he suddenly realizes what they're being taught in school is complete garbage. And so... people have been, and so that's the COVID lockdown out of school, combined with the critical race theory, to create a grassroots movement where a lot of these guys are now running for the school board because they realise the social engineering that is being basically. As in any totalitarian society, your kids are being raised to rat on you. And that's what's going on. And so you got these guys running for school board in Virginia, going to the school board meet, all the things. Incidentally, I don't want to keep saying self-quoting, but as you know, I've said for several years, what you can do is go to the school board meeting. The school going to being on a school board subcommittee transformed my view of political activism, because basically all this system, it's America's biggest structural weakness, and in particular it relies on the silence and acquiescence and fatalism of the majority. And right now people aren't being silent and acquiescent and fatalistic. They're going along to the meetings, they're demanding answers, and they're running to replace those guys. And that's good. And that's what you need. You need a lot more of that. Where's the... Oh, yeah, here we are. I want to get to this one. This is from Eric... Georgatos. I think it's a Greek name. Is it a Greek name? Georgatos. Perhaps it isn't. Anyway, G. Eric, and I apologize if I've mangled your Georgatos name. Eric says evidence of massive election fraud in 2020 is mounting. Most office holders on, quote, our side still run from the topic. And those who don't run stay on the safe turf of pointing out changes to election voting by mail in ballot laws that were not approved as required by the Constitution, by state legislatures. Yeah, they just ignored the Constitution, didn't they? But the evidence that is emerging from Seth Keschel, Trend Anomalies, Dr. Douglas Frank, Discovery of Algorithms, actually used in Ohio and elsewhere, and yes, Mike Lindell and Patrick Byrne, data packet capture indicating internet-directed vote manipulation originating in China, points to much more massive, coordinated, nefarious election fraud. Nobody in the US government is on the side of exposing the fraud and taking action to remedy it. One question, do you think the American people en masse can force remedial action? I'm thinking of the Egyptians who rose up to throw out Morsi, the late Mr. Mohamed Morsi, and succeeded despite having no constitution or historical heritage that would support them. They were simply righteously indignant, and their government had to bow to them. It's not quite the same. There were also tremendous shortages of things like bread, which helps. Second question, do you think we'll ever see the day when a Pence or Barr or McConnell or a majority of SCOTUS justices will admit error, e.g. we didn't know then, pre-January 20th, what we know now, and calling for reversal of the fraudulent 2020 election of Biden? Well, the answer to that one is no, because, you know, you're looking to Amy Coney Barrett to wipe out the election result of November the 3rd and remove Biden from the White House. That's never going to happen because if it were to happen, her house would be burned down and her kids would be threatened at school and her husband would be attacked. And those are things that people take into account. And the whole point of the whole stupid interlude between election night and the new guy taking office becomes a thing in itself. You know, you couldn't have stolen that election. When was the election? Thursday, and I think the media proclaimed Biden. The election was Tuesday, and the media proclaimed Biden the winner on Saturday. Well, in the Westminster system, the election is generally on a Thursday, and the new prime minister is living at 10 Downing Street by the Saturday. So you can't have that. It's this stupid, mostly peaceful transition of power that enables the theft. And it's stupid, and I don't care if it's in the Constitution. It shouldn't exist. And in this case, what it does is it puts a clock. Anyone who's, you know, interested in narratives, as we say now, knows that it's useful to put a clock on a situation. You can see it in any thriller. It's counting down. We've got 20 seconds before the space laser obliterates New York or whatever. You can see that in a zillion movies. And January 20th puts a clock on the drama for everybody. There's a difference between facts that emerge before January 20th and facts that emerge after January 20th. And if you keep that's one reason why this is all happening now, because it's after January the 20th. So, for example, even assuming that all the new evidence is correct and verifiable, what are you going to do about it? You're going to take it to the Supreme Court in some fashion. You're going to find a route to the Supreme Court. And then you're going to be asking a court that's got three lefties, two principled originalists, that's Alito and Thomas, And then this four-man block of swingers, the biggest bunch of swingers, it's a real swingers party. And they don't like any, they go with Roberts, they don't want anything controversial. So you would have, if you were to say, well, yes, in theory, we should remove this guy from the Oval Office and restore the other guy. But they'll find some, you know, constitutional reason why that can't. Why that can't happen. It's terrible. It's a terrible situation. I'm not, you know, you mentioned this data packet vote manipulation originating in China. Actually, in the end, things like that don't help because you are asking. I said this, I hate to do the self-quoting thing. I'm so weary of it. But if you go back to what I was saying by mid-November, I was saying, let's keep it simple. Let's focus on Fulton County, Georgia. And the things that went on there that are captured in video that you can see that there's footage. Now, Tucker, oddly enough, was talking about Fulton County, Georgia, just last night. The point you're trying to make is that the Democrats stole the election. It's not really helpful to say Chairman Xi stole the election. It really isn't, because you're asking a district court judge. You're taking these things to courthouses where judges are listed, their street address is listed in the phone book, and they're supposed to, you know, it's all true. The election was stolen. The Georgia thing is clear. You know, the Fulton County thing is good. You build it this way. You say, can we prove that Georgia was stolen? Can we prove that Pennsylvania was stolen? Can we prove that Nevada was stolen? You get whatever it is, three states, you change the result. And you're not going to get a judge, you're not going to get John Roberts and four other judges to pull Joe Biden out of the White House. And actually, at this stage, what would happen then is they would say, well, these are like five Bush, Trump appointees who are trying to reverse the votes of the American people. And they wouldn't. But what you could do is you can put a question mark over his result, make it plain he should never have been elected, and get it out of there. But in the end, this crap system, the worst system in the electoral system in the election world, where we're just like in the crappiest parts of dictatorial Africa, boxes of votes are being driven around in the middle of the night. In real countries, votes in real systems, votes are counted where they're cast. You know? I said it all. I spent that entire stupid, mostly peaceful transition of power talking about it. Let's see if we got... We must have another. Oh, James. We've had a lot of Jameses today. I'm a bit sorry about that. We've been disproportionately favourable toward Jims and Jameses. But this one says, James, I see the newest batch of emojis on phones will include icons of pregnant men. On Twitter, a bunch of people are laughing at it, but I wonder if the normalisation of this is more serious. No. Thoughts? Well, as I always say, nobody who matters is laughing at it. The American the American Booksellers Association just apologized for sending out a book by Abigail Schreier. This is for all the small bookstores, the only alternatives to Amazon. And the American Booksellers Association, which is like 120 years old, 150 years old, whatever it is apologizing for sending a book out to bookstores that is regarded as transphobic. In other words, they're apologizing for sending out a book people might disagree with. And everyone's saying, oh, that's not enough. We hate you. You think you can send out Abigail Schreier's book and then just say you're going to have an investigation and report back on how to ensure that this doesn't happen again? This is the American Booksellers Association. And they're saying, oh, we only send out books now that everybody is lockstep agreement with and reflects the consensus of the moment. So we can't send out Abigail Schreier's book about the epidemic of girls deciding they're boys at high school. We can't send that out. We apologise. We're trying to erect a system that will ensure it doesn't happen. Die, American Booksellers Association, and any small bookstore that thinks it's in the book business when it only wants books it agrees with. You're not. The American Booksellers Association is now in the digital book-burning business. To hell with you. I won't have anything to do with them. No book of mine will ever, ever, ever be distributed by the American Booksellers Association ever again, because they're bums who are actually destroying literacy, destroying literature, destroying books. I won't do business with them, you know. Because I don't care. It's not important. It's not in. I'd rather not be in some. What was the one that used to have the Jim Jeffords thing? Jim. Its only bookmarks were "Thank you, Jim," because Jumpin' Jim Jeffords had jumped from the Republicans to the Democrats 20 years ago. Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. I think that's bust and out of business now. And good riddance to it. To hell with them. Because the American Booksellers Association, we sell books you already agree with. Well, okay, then what's the point of reading it? Pathetic. So you say, James, that on Twitter a bunch of people are laughing at the emojis of pregnant men. Well, those people aren't going to have Twitter accounts in a year or two's time. And then nobody will be laughing at the pregnant men. And the pregnant men, yeah, what's the big deal? You uptight squares, will you just get with the program? You know, some men have ovaries and some men don't. It's just a few. You might be lucky, find a couple of guys out there who still don't have ovaries. But basically, there's perfectly a woman can give birth to a child. A man can give birth to a child. That's just the way it is. You uptight squares. And it's more than that. It's like if you laugh at that idea on Twitter, you're perpetrating an act of violence. Violence, and you need to be shut down. Yeah. Like I said, you know, sooner or later, people have to get more. I used to mention this on Rush a couple of years ago, and people would say, why are you talking about this? It's the abolition of sex. What's more important, the abolition of sex or a Paul Ryan corporate tax cut? You know, the abolition of biological sex is more important. But enjoy all those talk shows with the conservative talk shows with the hard rock Eye of the Tiger theme music, and then the conversation about nothing that matters. Mark Stein is my name, and I will be back in about an hour's time on 7-8 Radio in the UK. Less than an hour's time, actually, I think about 45 minutes' time. With 7-8 Radio is an easy listening station, and it's easy listening music, so you won't hear Eye of the Tiger. And then that's coming up at 9 p.m. London time. And then at 7 p.m. Eastern time, what's that? What am I doing there? Oh, Fox News Prime Time with Pete Hegseth. I hope you'll tune in for that live across America. And then a couple of hours after that, around about 9 p.m. Eastern time, we'll have our latest episode of our latest Tale for Our Time, Jack London's Burning Daylight. You'll like it. It's an interesting glimpse of America in an age of innovation and energy. Imagine that. Jack London's Burning Daylight coming up 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We got that all over the weekend. And we also have the latest installment, Mark Stein's Passing Parade. We'll have one of our summer poetry specials on Sunday and a little more Song of the Week. We'll have Rick McGuinness on movies. I think Tal Backman is going to be here at Stein Online tomorrow. So lots of good stuff for you to listen out for. But I thank you for your questions. Hope they weren't all too finely focused. But my advice is to look at what those guys are doing at the school board. They put this thing on the table because they heard what was the garbage that their kids were being shoveled during the year of school shutdowns, and they started going to school board meetings, and some of them are running for school board. That's what you have to do. In a politicized society, you either have to take the cultural levers or you have to win elections. The right doesn't even play for the cultural levers, which is why all the kids are lefties by the time they're 18. And the elections are stolen by the Democrats. So where is the right in that equation? You know? Yeah, you've got to either clean up your dirty, stinking, filthy, rotten, corrupt election system, or you've got to start playing for the cultural levers of society. But right now, the right does. Oh, send money now to sendmoneynow.com. If that's the conservative movement, it's insufficient to the times. We have the military. They've now done to the military what they've done to the Boy Scouts with that idiot general, Thoroughly Modern Millie, talking about white rage and all the rest of it. This is a military brass. The world's most lavishly funded generals, all the 4-star, 5-star, 137-star generals who haven't won a war in 75 years. That's near to within living memory. The last boys who went ashore on D-Day are now nonagenarians. And so we have a general staff that hasn't won a war in 75 years, but thinks that the priority is to have critical race theory and celebrate diversity. Pushton goat herds with fertilizer have just kicked your ass. Pushton goat herds with fertilizer. You can't beat goat herds and you want to teach critical race theory. Shameful. Okay, that all do it, and we will be back in 45 minutes on 7-8 Radio, and we'll have another Clubland Q&A before you can even think about it. Stay safe, stay free.